If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello.
Hello, Richard.
How are we?
I'm very well, thank you. You?
Good, thanks.
Good, good, good. On with the show. This week's guest is a goalkeeper on a march to rack up 500 career appearances. Starting his career in the Championship, he represented England at under-21 level, and a year after playing in a European Championship final for the under-21s, he earned his first call-up to the senior side under then-manager Fabio Capello. He's also the man, I'm delighted to say, ousted Richard Lee as Watford's number one. Now playing for Barnet, Scott Loach. Welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Hi, mate. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you on.
This is it. Do you know my first memory, actually? I'll just bring this up now, was the Kooks. You know the band, the Kooks?
There
was,
yeah.
Where was that pre-season trip? We played that song on repeat, if I remember, over
it
and over.
It was Denmark, because I think it was You Got Me into Prison Break. I watched Prison Break
that's
in the room.
Right. Prison yeah. Break and the Kooks. There you go. That's what
and
we
then,
got. In.
So I'm blaming you for the reason I'm covered in tattoos.
Yeah.
You are football's equivalent of Wentworth Miller. There we go.
Yeah.
Well, Scott, we do love a first on this podcast. We've had many over the podcast that we've done with various goalkeepers, but for you, it's your league debut for Watford. You came on against Reading, you replaced Mark Poom after 4 minutes, so you already had the added pressure of being the substitute goalkeeper, and then there was the ghost goal. I'm going to paint the picture here for listeners. A corner came in, it was contested in the area, the ball went off. Noel Hunt, the Reading winger, hooked it back into play. Andre Bike, the Reading midfielder, headed it towards you. You made the save, but it was given as a goal. Assistant referee Nigel Bannister waved his flag. He gave it as a goal. The referee Stuart Atwell went with those instructions. Nothing was overturned. A ghost goal was given.
Yeah, I know. It's watched it many a time, so I still explain to people that don't really know me that well or ask me about my Watford career to look at that goal. And I still not seen one or come across one person that can kind of see what the referee's seen there. It was funny, actually, because I played with Stephen Hunt at Ipswich, and my first memory of him is just running off celebrating, which I really didn't agree with at the time. Even him himself didn't know what was going on. And it's really confusing to talk about because it's just baffling. I think anybody watching it will, I can only imagine that the ref's gone off the word of a linesman and obviously trusted his judgment.
Well, this is it. I remember at the time, so it was obviously Mark Poom started the game and he got injured, didn't he? And that was obviously why you came on. So I remember I was actually in the change room with Poomy because he had done his, I think it was his collarbone, if I remember rightly, and he wasn't in a particularly good way. But then when I came back out and people were trying to explain to me what exactly had happened, and nobody could because it was so bizarre. And even now, as you say, the ball's gone off for the goal kick. You can only imagine that the linesman seen it go over the line and assumed it had obviously gone over the line in the goal. But even the whole situation, the fact that it was an attacking player that was then trying to keep the ball in play, you actually consider that even if it had gone over the line in the goal, why would an attacking player be trying to scoop it back out of the goal to bring it back into play? It just made no sense. It was big news, wasn't it, for a week or so. But for that to happen on your league debut, how did you deal with that afterwards?
I didn't really take it in at the time. I think, you know, when you're young, I think I could probably, this will probably speak for my whole first maybe year or 18 months. You get by an adrenaline, don't you, a little bit? So you don't really analyse what was going on. So I was just excited to be out there, really. I just kind of wanted to prove a point. Because I actually remember my first goal kick. I must have kicked it about 10 yards as well, just out of pure nervous energy. And then that happened. And I think, I don't know if that might have, you know, kind of in a weird way settled me into the game. Because it was kind of thinking, well, nothing can really go any more wrong than what's happened. And then from there, I just kind of, I remember I made a save from Jimmy Kebbe afterwards. And I felt good. I felt good during the game and just kind of try to put it to the back of my mind and not let myself worry about it.
And I remember that time quite well. From my point of view, and again, we've got different stories around that time because I remember I had an injury in pre-season, if I remember rightly, and you came back flying and you played the cup game, and that was your debut, wasn't it, the cup game? And my memory from that was, obviously I knew quite a bit about you anyway, we worked together for a couple of years at that point, if I remember rightly, but it was the fact that you came back absolutely flying, you were nailing your side volley. That was my memory of the cup game. You must have had five towards the end of the game, every one missile going into the corner, beautiful trajectory, and you could tell that you had the bit between your teeth, and it was just a matter of time before you were going to get your chance. Of course, then when your chance did come, it didn't last too long, if I remember right, because then you got the injury against Sheffield United, didn't you?
Obviously, the year before, I'd gone to Stafford Rangers and Bradford, and got a taste of football, so I came back, you know, really, obviously it's a completely different step up being in the Championship, but I felt that I was ready to play. And then, it was just a simple save at Bramall Lane. I don't know if you can remember, I dived down to my right, and just the way I landed, my hip bone just seemed to cut the muscle clean off that attaches from your stomach to your hip bone. It was a really weird feeling, because I remember getting up and it felt like I had cramp in my stomach. And then I took the goal kick, and then, as you probably can remember, I just couldn't walk. I just couldn't get off the pitch. I think Rolsey and someone else, maybe Richard Collins, carried me off the pitch, and you know the agony I was in the changing room was horrible. And it was again like a really freak accident, but it was one that couldn't be helped. They put it down to my growing.
Yeah, I want to just touch on, we won't go into too much detail about Stafford or Bradford, but I do remember Bradford one in particular, and I just wanted to ask you this. I remember a penalty save you made that to this day, I remember it as being one of the best saves I've ever seen. It's got to be up there in your top five saves you've ever made.
Yeah, because I went there for Morecambe. Sound like you now, saving penalties. But I went there with Morecambe, and I saved one for Morecambe against Macclesfield at the same ground the same month. And then obviously I came back and went alone to Bradford. I did the same thing again. But yeah, I didn't really know too much about it. It's definitely up there with one of my favourites for sure.
Do you know what? I was going to bring up penalties later in the podcast, but because Rich has jumped the gun, which he often does on this podcast and just goes rogue, there were two penalty saves in 2 months you made at Macclesfield. You made a good one alone at Morecambe, like you say, one at Bradford. There was a penalty save on your debut for Yeovil, which was an extraordinary experience because I think you met them a couple of hours before you were due to even play.
Yeah.
But out of all the penalty saves I've seen you make, there was one against Huddersfield when you were playing for Ipswich Town against James Vaughan. And that was another double save-esque. But what struck me about that was when you watch it back, you and James Vaughan actually do a bit of a high five afterwards, which is rarely seen when a striker misses a penalty or has a penalty saved, I should say.
Yeah, well, we was in the 21s together. And after every session, obviously building up to all the championships, we used to do penalties after every session. So I kind of had it in my head which way he was going to go. It's kind of a little bit like cat and mouse, because I think he was maybe thinking, oh, he knows which way I go, he might think I'm going to change it, kind of thing. And there was, you know, mutual respect for each other. He's someone that I bonded with when I was always away. So, you know, it was, I'd like to think it was a good save rather than a bad penalty. And I think it was just one of the things at the time. It was just a bit of respect from him towards me as well, to say, you know, well done, really.
Absolutely. Well, look, let's talk Watford, which is what we were going to get onto. Obviously, you were there when Rich was there. You made 130 consecutive appearances from November 2008 to September 2011. You were an ever-present in the Championship for two campaigns. The Watford Observer, I noticed, although perhaps slightly biased, I suppose, did describe one of your performances against Plymouth at the start of a season as world class. You got the call up to the England under 21 side and you played in that European Championship final against Germany in 2009. Just tell us what that was like for you.
Obviously, the experience was unbelievable, and playing in the final, no one can never take that away from me. But I was definitely at fault for the second goal, which kind of killed us. And you know, if you look at Germany's team, the quality they had kind of stopped us getting back into the game. But overall, the tournament was incredible. It was great to be around, and some of the players that were involved for the England side, and then, you know, like I said, back to the Germany team, you had Neuer, Ozil, Hummels, players like that. You had Balotelli, Italy. You know, we had the Spain team, Raul Garcia in there. It was some good big players on show. So to be a part of the actual campaign was, you know, really, really good for me. I've got, you know, kept all my memorabilia from there, and the training kit is something that I look back on, and you know, will hopefully show my little lad when he's older. So it was definitely a proud memory of mine.
Yeah, indeed. I wanted to know like how you felt going into the final. Because if I remember rightly, obviously Joe Hart was the other goalkeeper and he had a pretty good tournament, hadn't he? I think he, in the semi-final, something rings a bell. I think he had a particularly good game, if I remember. So did you feel any particular pressure going into the final? What was the reason Joe Hart didn't play the final? Just remind me, was it a...
He got two bookings. He got booked twice in the game leading up to it due to, you know, giving the striker some penalty. So in the semi-final against Sweden, he was, you know, he liked to shout at the penalty taker before they take it, and the ref booked him for it. So it was actually his second booking of the tournament. So he missed it. And obviously, there was me and Joe Lewis in the squad. And we didn't actually know until the night before who was going to play. Like, we had no idea. It was a strange one. I was really excited. Sometimes now, even when I'm playing now, I'll be playing against Maidenhead or, you know, Hartlepool or Jovan, and I'll get nerves sometimes. But I remember at the time, at that game, I had no nerves. I was just really looking forward to it. You know, I just thought it was an occasion that everyone would be watching, and I was playing for England, and to be out there was something that I could always look back on and say, you know, I've played in the European final.
Yeah, some names you mentioned there, obviously, in that final: Manuel Neuer, Mesut Ozil, Sandro Wagner, Mats Hummels, Sami Khedira, some world-class names there. And then a year later, you got that call up to the England senior squad. There were various circumstances, and we had Frankie Fielding on the podcast a few months back, and obviously he was the other goalkeeper that was there with you. He said it was quite a surreal experience for him going into that setup and going to eat breakfast with the likes of Wayne Rooney, who would actually introduce himself and be like, "Oh, hi, I'm Wayne, nice to meet you." And Frankie was very much like, "I know who you are, mate. You don't have to introduce yourself." Was it the same for you, or did you just take it in your stride?
No, it was the same. It was surreal, but I kind of, you know, because I knew Joe Hart and, you know, Milner and some of the lad, Adam Johnson was in there, and some of the lads that had been, Kieran Gibbs, that had been with the under-21s, it kind of made it a little bit easier. But I remember, speaking of Rooney, I remember, you know, I managed to get his top. He was great for me. And I remember one morning I sat down at breakfast with, obviously, with Joe Hart, Gary Cahill and Stephen Gerrard was there, and I just kept telling myself, like, this is big. You know, don't go back to your room. Just enjoy this moment. Don't walk away, just enjoy it. So I was talking to Joe, and then, you know, then Gary Cahill got up and left, and I thought, like, don't leave. And then Joe Hart left, and then I was just sat face to face with Stephen Gerrard. I was thinking, wow, this is surreal. But he knew absolutely everything about football. He knew about Watford. He was just a really great guy. He stayed there for a good 5-10 minutes, talked to me as if I'd been there the whole time, and was just had a really good general conversation with him. And I think that was the first morning I was there, and that just made me feel like, wow, if he can do that, I've got nothing to fear. And I guess that was him being a captain and a leader. Or, you know, you never know, it might have just been him as a person, but it really, really settled me in and made me feel really welcome.
I mean, it's a great story. It's interesting, though, isn't it, being in that position. I always remember when we made the Premier League, Eddie Boothroyd had a bit of a go at us because we played Manchester United, and after the game, everyone's swapping shirts with all the United players, and so we're all coming in with the different shirts. And I remember on the Monday, Eddie Boothroyd had a bit of a pop at us saying, like, look, you need to believe that you belong at this level. You can't be swapping shirts every game because it shows almost too much respect for the opposition. I guess in some ways, there must have been similarities where it's like, you're there, you deserve to be there. Your performances to that point had got you and given you that particular opportunity, but at the same time, you're in the same room as some incredible football minds, people that have played at the very highest level, great experience you can learn from. So how did you feel being in that environment? Was it quite a tough balance to find?
Yeah, if I'm looking back now, perfectly honest, I probably didn't believe that I did belong there. I was immature, not in a way that I acted like a kid, but, you know, in the way I'm just with the England squad, I instead of thinking, right, I'm here on merit or whatever, and what can I do to stay here, I probably kind of just rode the wave a little bit and just kind of went along, got along with it, instead of really making it kind of stick or really thinking to myself, right, I'm in here now, I want to be part of this, I've got a good chance. And maybe a bit of self-belief. It was kind of just like, oh, let's just kind of do this and see where it takes us, instead of actually thinking, right, I'm here now, let's make it stay, if that makes any sense.
We've since heard, Scott, and actually we spoke to Paul Robinson as well, who didn't have great things to say about Fabio Capello, I guess you could say. We've since heard from a few players that they weren't hugely enamoured with his methods, his man management with his players whilst he was England boss. Did you notice anything when you were there at the time that the feeling in the camp wasn't that of a hugely positive mood?
I didn't really pick up on that. I couldn't believe how little was said, really. You know, like before games or after games, and it was kind of like, You could get the feeling that, I don't know if he took to the players and the players didn't really take to him, if that makes any sense. It was, I remember sitting in the changing room before thinking, right, what's going to be said? It was, everyone was just getting ready and went out for the warm-up. And then afterwards, you know, I didn't really see him. That was the thing I found weird. I just didn't see a lot of him on the whole time I was away. I spent most of my time with Ben Foster or Joe Hart, and, you know, the goalie coach. And I just remember the outfield players doing your possessions and your small-sided games. I didn't really actually see. You know, I could be wrong, I could even turn a blind eye to it, but that's one of my memories looking back, that I didn't really see too much interaction with Capello and the players.
You touched on Ben Foster there, of course, someone that you got to know well at Watford as well. He was a big influence on you back then, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he's still, I still think he's one of the best I've ever seen in the flesh. And I think he's another one that I think he's got so much natural ability that I think he could be anything he wants. I think he's so good as a goalkeeper. I think as a person as well. I think his mental strength, and you know, obviously I don't know the inside and outside, but looking from where I am, I think how he deals with things, and he just seems to smile no matter what happens. And I always go back to the Paul Robinson goal, and I think even though Paul Robinson scored and they were battling for the England number one spot, Ben seemed to come out a bit better off with the way he reacted. And I always look at the stuff that he does and how he deals with things, and I still try and, you know, implicate that now in my own game, because I think if you're enjoying yourself then, or you're happy, then it could speak into performances as well.
So when you got that call up, you said you were away with England in 2010. It was at the height of your Watford career. Like I said, you'd made consecutive appearances. You were an ever-present for two campaigns at Vicarage Road. We had Andrew Lonergan on the podcast. And we mentioned to him that when he was at the height of his career with Preston, there was talk of a potential move to Arsenal in the Premier League. That never materialised. But for you, when you were at the height of your career with Watford, it was the other side of North London, wasn't it? It was Spurs and a potential move that almost came off at the time for you.
Yeah, I think, were you at the club, Richard, then?
Yeah, yeah. I remember deadline day very well.
Yeah, I remember, I didn't really know too much about it. And we had Sky Sports News, I think, in the room, where, and it came up on there in the cafeteria. And obviously, and Malky and came by the office and was like, we don't want you to go, we want you to keep playing. And, you know, I felt really wanted at Watford, you know, and I was only young. And in the back of my mind, well, in the front of my mind, it was just like, right, you're at a good level, you're young, you're playing, you've had this kind of success so far. So I didn't, you know, Richard knows my personality. I'm not the kind of guy that kicks up a fuss, or I don't really get angry, or again, maybe a little bit. Looking back, you can say I could have forced the issue, and you never know where my career could have gone down that route. But I was just, again, happy just to go along with things and just keep playing and enjoying where I was at the time.
And you're right. No, you know, I do know your character very well and how you react to things. Looking back now, would you have done anything differently around that time? And I say that sort of based on my own experience as well, where the more realisations I've had in regards to football, and the cliche, strike when the iron's hot, you know, you realise that there's so many lows in football. When you have those highs and you have that little bit of momentum, you see people that seem to jump at the right time, and they always take that little leap forward and manage to maximise their potential. Do you look back and think, oh, maybe I could have done something different?
I definitely think, looking back, whether it's because I've gone to learn on what's gone on in my career and learn how football works, I think I would have definitely tried to pursue it or force the issue a little bit more to at least let me speak to Tottenham, because, you know, I always look at Carl Darlow as an example. When he was at Forest, he probably had a similar kind of career to me, as in one, maybe two seasons at Forest, and then went and got a big move to Newcastle. And then you kind of look back and think, oh, I want a piece of that. Do you know what I mean? And looking at it now, Tottenham's such a big club and Premier League, and I think it'd be silly to not say that you would have liked it to happen. So I think, you know, if I could have my time again, I don't regret anything I've done, if that makes any sense. But I think the opportunity to go and play at a big club, or definitely be around a big club, I think I definitely would have tried to force the issue, or at least had the conversation with Tottenham and seen what could have happened.
There's the cross. Loach waiting for it. And it's a great save by Loach. It's a wonderful piece of goalkeeping. Odichai got a header on it, Loach saw it late and did enough.
As it turned out, Scott, it was then a couple of years later, after that England call-up, that you did eventually depart from Watford. And I think one of the things, when looking over your career and various interviews that you've given, that strikes me is that you're always very honest. You've already mentioned it on this podcast that you're very honest. And just looking at some quotes that you gave towards the end of the 2010-11 season, where you said that perhaps your performance had dipped off a little bit, and you said, you know, instead of playing four good games and one bad game, you were very in and out. You had one all right game and one bad game, and you were really honest about the fact that you wanted to improve. You said, there's no point in me lying to myself. I set targets. I want to get five solid performances before an international break, and then I want to come back and I want to go again. In terms of that improvement and life under Sean Dyche, who came in as Watford manager, and I know that he brought in Thomas Cusack on loan for you, what was that like as a learning curve for you, having been Watford's number one and being called up to the England side, and then the tide just slightly turning a bit?
At the time, obviously, I was human. I'm not going to lie. I was thinking, well, you know, what are you doing? I think that was because I'd been used to just playing. But then as I got to know Thomas, and he was so good with me. He was unbelievable with me. Can't speak any more highly of. He was very, very good with me. And he said he looked at some of the games before he joined Watford, and he kind of stripped it all down and kind of said to me, go back to basics. You're kind of trying too hard. And I did feel like I was trying to You know, if we were winning 1-0 and I had nothing to do, I wanted to go and do that thing to contribute to the game instead of just doing my job. And he kind of simplified it for me. And it was probably the best thing that happened to me. And I was definitely ready for a break at that time at Watford. I played all them games on the bounce. And I think mentally I was just, my performances wasn't there. They weren't consistent enough. And so when Thomas came in, I gave me a chance to just kind of sit back and have a look at it all. And I'd like to think it kind of worked for me a little bit.
Just on that note, it's an interesting comment that you said, like you were ready for a break. Obviously, you had a large number of games in a row. I mean, you know, not checking the stats earlier, you played a hell of a lot more than I did for Watford over your time there. You know, a lot of games in a row. You said you were ready for a break, and you touched on the fact that mentally you were ready. Was that like lack of motivation? Was it a feeling that you'd stood still? Was there anything in particular that you can remember where you felt a little bit mentally fatigued and felt that you needed that break?
I think it was, we played Tottenham in the FA Cup. I think I remember playing, I can't remember what it was, Tottenham or Cardiff, you know, within the space of a week, and there was a game in between. And I remember being at fault for a goal in the Tottenham game, definitely Cardiff later on. And it was after that I was thinking, this is tough, you know, this is. That's when I first remember really starting to get nerves. I remember sat down with, I think it was Doncaster at home, because I remember saying to Chamber, like, you know, this, I've never been nervous before in my life. But now I'm playing against Doncaster and I'm nervous. And that's when I thought, you know, maybe I need to take a little step back and have a little look at it. You know, I think I was just overthinking things. You know, when a shot was coming, I was thinking, right, I need to parry this, or I was misjudging it. And, you know, instead of kind of just thinking, right, keep the ball out of the net, just be solid. Kind of, I was just overthinking everything that came in and around the box. And then I was always thinking, you know, don't put that cross in, you know, and stuff like that. So I kind of went a little bit, well, what's the lack of motivation? I just getting a little bit negative about, you know, my thoughts and stuff like that, if that makes sense.
That does. I mean, it's I talked to some of my goalkeepers about this now. It becomes a vicious cycle, because of course then the negative thoughts will lead to more negative feelings, you know, and of course each thought releases a chemical in your body. So with each negative thought, you're making yourself feel worse and worse, which naturally is making you think worse and worse. And that's kind of, I suppose that's the hardest bit. It sounds like we've got so many similarities to when we were younger, and I had a similar period of time at Watford myself, and sounds like a similar conversation with Malky myself as well at some point, because yeah, you get to that, and then that is where that break just allows you to switch off for a period of time and actually almost reassess and reevaluate what it is and why you're playing the game. That was it for me anyway. And then obviously when I came back at Brentford, I felt that much better, because it was a fresh start. But not even the fresh start, it's a fresh mind, I think would be the expression I'd look for, where you're going into a game with excitement, the thought of playing in front of a crowd, the thought of making a great save, contributing in the way that you know you can, maximising what it is that you can offer, rather than worrying about things that are out of your control. And I was the same. I remember games at Watford where it was a case of almost praying they wouldn't put across an in-swinger on me when it was wet, windy and cold, you know, praying that it'd be 7-8 yards out so I didn't have to come, which is crazy to think now. But at that period of time, when your mind isn't in the best state of mind, yeah, you're reliant on luck to get through games.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I actually remember bumping into Fozzie on a night out of Leamington, funny enough, and he was like that. He was kind of just saying, you know, you've got to, your negative thoughts will, you know, make bad things happen. Like, if you look at keepers that are positive, I mean, everyone speaks about David James, but the one thing with him, he was brave and he was coming no matter what, whether he missed it or. And I think sometimes you create your own luck. And I felt that because I was being so negative, I was letting things go in that I was thinking, oh, you know, that should really not be going in. And that's kind of where I found myself towards that last couple of months at Watford.
It's staggering how often David James gets mentioned on this podcast, by the way, especially when we have this type of discussion. Now, yeah. Scott, you eventually moved on from Watford. You went to your boyhood club, Ipswich Town. So on one hand, you're making what is almost a dream move, I suppose. But on the other, you're leaving a club where you made your name. Was it difficult to leave Watford, or was it purely about an exciting challenge ahead at Ipswich?
I loved it at Ipswich, don't get me wrong. It took me back from watching him as a kid and, you know, seeing likes of Richard Wright. And I remember Richard Wright came into train when I was there. And I just remember being an eight-year-old seeing Richard Wright. I was thinking, oh, this is amazing. But then, at the same time, when I look back now, I was like a rabbit in the headlights, because Ipswich came in, everything that I had personally involvement with them, obviously I jumped at the opportunity, when maybe, I think because I was so used to playing, instead of actually sitting back and thinking, no, just bide your time, I had a year left, and Zola was great with me when he came in, but he said he wants to bring someone in, and I think if I'd have just kind of took my time, you know, with my decision instead of kind of rushing into it just because it was Ipswich, then I think as well my career may have gone down a different path then. I think I jumped into it too early, just because of everything that was going on, instead of actually taking a look back and thinking, right, you're at Watford, you're at a good club, just keep working hard. And I think that goes back to that immaturity, which I said when I was away with England, instead of thinking, right, you're here now, let's make it work, it was kind of like, well, Whippet, you've come in, let's just go.
So obviously you made this move to Ipswich and you had Malcolm Webster. Of course, he was there for many, many years. You touched on Richard Wright. Funnily enough, actually, Richard Wright, he was on my wall, a poster on my wall as a kid.
Yeah. Was he really?
So random. Yeah, do you know what? Because it was that period when he broke through at Ipswich, and people don't remember this, he was extraordinary for a couple of years. Oh. I'll never forget him in the cream kit. I watched him play at Vicarage Road, and he was incredible. And Ipswich were up the top of the league in the Championship, and it was all down to Richard Wright, as far as I was concerned. He was one of my biggest inspiring factors. In fact, we need to get him on the podcast, Speedle. That's what we need to do.
I've been looking to meet quite a few people in football, I'm sure, as you have, but he's one of the people that I was like, oh, it's Richard Wright. And people find that so daft, but I just still picture him as when I was an 8-year-old and him coming down, because obviously I was at Ipswich as a kid at a School of Excellence, and him being there, and he's still, like, to me, this big, he is like an idol of mine. He's one of my favourite keepers I've ever seen, just because he's my idol as a kid, along with Peter Schmeichel.
That's it, and it is. I mean, so again, look, for a lot of the young goalkeepers, it is. They will associate with a particular goalkeeper. And I look back, as much as now people ask me, who is your favourite goalkeeper of all time? Of course, you'll say the usuals, the Peter Schmeichels, for me, Iker Casillas. But actually, Richard Wright was at the time. But one of the things, and the reason, there is a reason for me talking about this and Malcolm Webster, was that Malcolm Webster had a very specific style of goalkeeper, I remember. Richard Wright, and there was Shane Supple, there was a couple of others that came through around that time, and I remember they had quite a similar technique. How did you find that, going from, it was Alec Chamberlain, I'm assuming, that you're working with at Watford, to then going and working with Malcolm Webster? Did you find much of a difference in terms of how you work with Malcolm as opposed to how you work with Alec?
Yeah, it was so hard. It was so different. I remember, because Malcolm loves a little cone. It's always you're touching something before, or you're going around something, and don't get me wrong, his sessions made you sharp and they were really good, but it was the whole side of training was so different to what I was used to. I find Alex very technical and covers all bases. He's one of the best coaches I've ever worked with, but Malcolm was a lot more physical, I felt, a lot more footwork, a lot more up and down stuff. And it did probably take me, I remember the first session, I was absolutely blowing like never before. I did find his sessions, fairly hard to get used to. But, I just took it again. I just thought, every goalkeeper coach is different. And when you look back, when you do speak of the kind of goalkeepers he has, Lee Camp, Bartosz Piotrowski, all keepers that have come through under Malcolm. So I'm guessing he does have a certain style. Maybe I wasn't kind of suited to that, but, I was looking back on it, I've not really thought about that, actually.
No, that's kind of what I was touching on, I suppose, because it is interesting. You're right, he's certainly been one of the best over the years. He's certainly got one of the biggest reputations out there. But it is interesting as to how certain goalkeepers seem to align with certain types of goalkeeper coaches. So, I won't name names, but certain goalkeepers I know at the moment, they don't necessarily, or they shouldn't work that hard because of their body type. It has to be more technical. And in order to get the best out of them on a Saturday, it'll be a very different build-up to, say, well, someone like myself, actually, when I was younger, for me, it was all about power and spring, explosivity. So really early on in the week, I'd have to be working myself into the ground, I felt, in order to feel my best for a Saturday. And I guess it's interesting to see where you sometimes see that where, a good example would be the lads at Brentford. They've now obviously gone for a Spanish goalkeeper and they've got a Spanish goalkeeper coach. They've got David Raya working with a Spanish goalkeeper coach. The goalkeepers last year, a couple of them now have moved on to different clubs. We're seeing some great stuff from Dan Bentley this season. Arguably wasn't his best season last season, but he was very good the season before under Simon Royce. You do wonder whether a certain type of goalkeeper coach can suit a goalkeeper in the same way in which a certain type of manager and a certain style of play can suit a goalkeeper. Which, obviously talking about how you played and back then, my memories of you being that your distribution was always very long, very accurate. You had a lovely side volley on you. Like the Watford style that we played at the time, it seemed to really suit your game, certainly in the early days. Did you find that was the same at Ipswich?
To a certain extent, yeah. But it was, I think what I found difficult as well at Ipswich was, I signed for Watford around 17. And I kind of come through with everybody and there was kind of a young core there, wasn't there? It's like, Eddie Mariappa and Lee Hodgson, people like that. We'd all kind of been there together. And I think the thing that I struggled with as well at Ipswich, I walked into a team full of men and that was a kind of shock to the system as well. I'd probably not been used to that before. Obviously, I know we had Eustee and Tommy Smith and people like that, but I think because the majority of us, like when we had Cleves on loan as well and Lansby, we was a young squad at Watford when I was playing. But Ipswich obviously had the, your Daryl Murphy, your Jason Scotland's, people like that. And I did find it hard to come by because it was, it was a kind of like you have to perform, otherwise you're getting it. And I've probably kind of not really been used to that.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Just looking to tease that defence again. Smith, little chip. Great save by Wright. It's Cunago. Always a dangerous customer from this range. Back heel towards Quinn. Good save by Loach.
We often discuss loan spells on this podcast, Scott, and some goalkeepers have different views on them. Some goalkeepers are very positive, some a little bit negative. Now, you were away on loan for seven different clubs when you were at Lincoln. That was what it was. You were a young kid at the time, so it was natural that you went around the local circuit and played for various clubs in and around that area. At Watford, you had a few loan spells before you broke into the first team. Again, completely natural. You had the spell at Ipswich and then moved on to Rotherham. And then the loans started happening a little bit again. You were at Bury, Peterborough and Yeovil in the space of one season. Was that difficult for you, as you were then an established goalkeeper, to have to deal with having to go round different clubs? And I mentioned the spell you had at Yeovil and the story of the fact that your first game against Walsall, you pretty much met the players at 6pm that evening for a 7:45pm kickoff.
The Ipswich Rotherham kind of time in my career was, yeah, I jumped into the chance to go to Rotherham because they were the Championship team. And you know, I don't want to say too much about Steve Evans because I know people have their own opinions on him, but we just didn't see eye to eye.
It seems like most goalkeepers we have on this podcast have worked with Steve Evans at some stage or another, to be honest.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. He's obviously had success where he's been and stuff like that, but it was kind of, he wasn't for me and I wasn't for him, I think. You know, but credit to him, he didn't hold me back, because I've seen him do some bizarre things, but he did let me go on loan. Bury was kind of the best thing and worst thing that ever happened to me, because I went there and had a stinker. I had a really bad 2 weeks. I kind of lost a bit of interest in football. Kind of came back and thought, right, I need to get myself back to where I can be or where I was going. And then obviously it was actually Ben Anik, I think, that got injured at Peterborough. And he said to Jimmy Walker, who was the Golder coach at the time, so this is what I've been told, go and get Loachie, you know, he'll do this for a month, which kind of filled me with so much confidence. And like Richard says, you know what it's like when a manager or a player or someone backs you as a keeper, it makes you feel 10 feet tall. And so I went there kind of buzzing, and Darren Ferguson pulled me in. He said, don't care where you've been, what you've done, I like you, you're here, just play. And I had a really good month, a really, really good month actually. And in that time we played the Oval, and I think they had Jed Steer, who'd just gone back, and they needed a keeper. And I went there and kind of continued the run of form that I had at Peterborough there. And I just wanted to prove to people that, you know, I made a few bad decisions, but I'm still here. I'm still about. And I want to, ultimately, I want to play games. I want to play football. I want to be in a team. I want to show people what I can do. And so we're kind of the loan system. It doesn't really bother me where I've been or what I've done. I want to play games. Hence why I moved to Hartlepool. You know, I just wanted to play as many games as I can and kind of show people that I've still got that ability and I can play season after season, hopefully make my way back up there.
On the topic, Scott, of working with certain goalkeeper coaches and certain managers, we have to mention Notts County and Ricardo Moniz. Are you happy to talk about him?
Yeah.
Now, I listened to you saying in one interview during 1 week with Notts County, you'd been given a chance under Jamie Fullerton, who'd come in to replace Ricardo Moniz. And you were quite open about the fact that Moniz described you as soft. Now, that must have been quite a hard thing to take at the time. Or did you use that as almost fuel to think, I'm going to prove him wrong?
I've had it a few times. Yeah. I had it at Ipswich. Like, I remember Mick McCarthy, who, by the way, one of the best managers I've worked for, with the way he was with players. He said, you know, you're too nice. And you know, like I said to Richard earlier, he knows my personality. And I remember Moniz pulled me into his office because he randomly put me in for a game early on in the season and made me captain out of the blue, which was, you know, which I thought, well, this is a bit odd, like, fair enough playing me, and made me captain, which obviously I was buzzing. And then we had a bit of a bad spell, so I went to see him, like, I want to play. And he was like, his exact words were, that goal at the weekend, yeah, I think you save it. I think you save more goals than Roy. But he just stood up and went, but you're too soft, and then sat back down. And I was like, well, I don't know what you mean, you know. I think because Roy Carroll was such a vocal character and would tell people exactly what he thought, I think the manager wanted me to do that, but I was trying to explain that that's not my personality, and he just didn't get that, and that's what, you know, he was saying I was too soft, and but, you know, managers have their opinions, and that's just what he thought at the time.
Do you know, on that note, because this is, again, it's a very different subject from anything we've discussed here on this podcast, and again, when I talk to some of the lads that I work with, I'll often say to them, and it's difficult, but I'll often say to them, play the game. And what I mean by that is that if you put yourself in the manager's shoes, what is it that they want to see from not just their goalkeeper, but any player? What sort of, you know, is it staying late in the gym? Is it doing the extra work that's needed to better yourself? Now, of course, you need to do it for yourself, and it can't be something that's fake. It can't be something that doesn't align with your values, your morals, because then it's not going to be genuine. But actually, the whole idea of playing the game, how many players have we both seen throughout our career that maybe have exceeded where they could be because they built brilliant relationships with managers, with coaches, and the like? And I just wonder, you know, I look back at mine, I sometimes question whether I could have done a little bit more on that front. But at the same time, it's very hard, because if it's not you, it's not genuine, then you don't want to be something that you're not. You don't want to fake it just to be in the manager's good books, for instance. But do you ever look back at situations you've had at different clubs and thought, do you know what, maybe I could have, using that term again, played the game a little bit better?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think Ipswich, and, well, maybe not so much Ipswich, because at the time I was still on that adrenaline rush from Watford, but I think at Notts I could have played the game more. I mean, Rotherham was just under Steve. I don't know what game you could have played to kind of win him over, but yeah, like you said, Notts, I think the word busy gets used a lot in football, doesn't it? And I think there's a difference in doing your gym stuff, or like you said, doing the right thing at the right time. And it wasn't really until I had a little loan spell at York that I thought, sod this, I'm looking after myself. And I think that's when, since then, I felt like my game's gone on a bit. I know I've obviously not playing at the level I feel like I want to, but I definitely look back and think, you know, could I've done things differently? But, and like I said to you, I don't know how you can change your personality, if that makes any sense.
Makes perfect sense, Scott. And I like that you mentioned York there, because obviously you went on loan to York and eventually it didn't work out for the club. For you, you had a very good spell. They went down to the sixth tier. I talked about your honesty earlier on, and you said at the time when your loan spell finished that, look, I had a great time here, but I'm 28 now. I can't be focusing on playing in the sixth tier of English football. That's just not where I am. So you're very honest about that, and you moved on to Hartlepool. And fortune started upturning again. You know, you were an ever-present for two campaigns. Yet again, you got a double Player of the Year award in your first season there. Eventually, you've moved on to Barnet, but it's almost like your career is coming back full circle a little bit.
This all goes back to managers and goalkeeper coaches and confidence in you. I think what Richard says, I think, you know, I hit the manager I felt wanted. He said to me straight away, you're going to be my vice-captain, which again made me feel 10 feet tall. I think going into the conference, I think some of the lads probably looked at the career I've had and kind of automatically gave me instant respect. And then obviously Ross Turnbull came in, the goalie coach. It was just one of the things that we hit off. We had a great relationship. We'd do certain things. We'd analyse every game. When Richard talks about methods of training, we'd work on the stuff that would have worked for me. So there'd be no good doing a speed session or working on the spread that Kasper Schmeichel does, because I physically can't do it. So we'd work on something else. And we kind of tailored training around my ability, really. And I think they put their faith in me and just trusted me to do my job, and everything just seemed to go really well there. And I'd like to say the same type of the Barnet. Darren Curry's a very similar manager to what I've had at Hartlepool again, and put his faith in me, and we're trying to work on what's good for me. So it's hopefully I can keep improving at the same time, and like you said, hopefully full circle, work my way back up into the league.
Yeah, and obviously now you're at Barnet. You mentioned that you want to play in the league, and something I do have to ask is that I'm aware, obviously knowing goalkeeper coaches and knowing the goalkeeper market in the way that I do, that you had a lot of interest and offers from league clubs in the summer. And obviously you chose Barnet for a reason. You obviously don't need to name the league clubs that were interested in you, but why did you choose Barnet over some of the League 2, League 1 options that you had?
From what I actually know of, there was only the one league club that was kind of like a strong firm offer. I think there was a lot of interest. One was my little girl starts school in September, so I couldn't choose this club just because it meant uploading the family and moving a really long, long way away. And I looked at Barnet and I looked at the setup and I thought, you know, we've got a good chance here of maybe going up. And I just wanted to continue playing. You know, when you've been playing off the back of two seasons at Hartlepool, I wanted to continue the form going. And I thought, you know, I'm only 31. If I can go and have another good season, then, you know, I'm sure league clubs maybe look at me then and think, yeah, this playing is consistent, and kind of hoping that offer will still be there next year. But just wanted to keep playing, and that was the main thing for me, really. And it was a family decision, just to keep the family and the kids settled, really.
It's interesting at the age you're at, because, and I have this conversation with a lot of players as to what the route is to get back to where you want to get to. Now, you know, being very honest and open and honest, obviously at your age, it's not going to be one of them where you necessarily get signed by a Premier League club, of course. More so for the fact that even if you're doing well enough, more for the fact that obviously a lot of clubs, they want the projects, they want the resale value on younger players so they can move them on. However, we do see examples of, for a start, given that, you know, you're still doing as well as you are, there's no reason you can't play well into your mid-30s, even late 30s. So do you look at it as almost like a 5-6 year plan to gradually climb the levels? And have you got a target in mind as to what level you'd love to get back to if things were to go right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like one thing I do now is I really look after myself and look after my body. In my head, I'm telling myself I want to play till I'm 35. I don't even want to consider being a two. I'd like to just keep playing until I'm 35, get as many games as I can, get as much experience as I can. But I definitely believe I could play in League One. Obviously, you need the opportunity to go and play. It's not just as easy as saying it. But I think by doing that, if I can kind of play another season or two at Barnet and hopefully get promoted myself, or, you know, work my way back into League Two or League One, and I definitely see that's where I could be. And then who knows, in the future, a lot of Championship clubs take on number three now, sort of for later on in my career. But I think at the minute, I definitely have got my sights set on League One. It's just finding the right path to get there. And I think by playing games is only going to help.
Just wanted to discuss players that you've played with, goalkeepers that you've worked alongside. Of course, the man opposite me, Richard Lee, is one. I'm hoping you've got a bit of dirt to dish on him. Mark Poon was at Watford with you at the time as well. I'm intrigued to know what he was about. You mentioned Roy Carroll you were at Notts County with as well. Often people have a story or two to tell about Roy Carroll. Is there anything that sticks out in particular for you with goalkeepers that you've worked with?
Poon was just insane. He was... You know, if we were doing shots on the angle and we did 10 one side and then he got called over, I remember he had to go back and finish the other side before we went in the gym early on in the morning. And I remember him actually saying to us he didn't believe in his own ability. That's why he felt like he had to work as hard as he did, yeah. Which I thought was unreal, to say the career he had.
Do you know, just on that, I've got to touch on those two. One, yeah, he had OCD. So to the point where if he did a set on one side and he was called over with a team, like, everyone would have packed up and gone in from training. He'd be dragging Alec Chamberlain over to do the other side so that it evened everything up.
Well, the other side of the goal?
Yeah, yeah. So imagine you did the angled shots from one side and everyone's finished training, everyone's warming down. Poomy will drag Chamberlain over 50 yards to go to the goal to do 10 more shots from the other side so it's even. Uh-huh. So that was one. But the other one, the gym one's an interesting one. You're right. He said, because he used to get in, he had his own key to the gym. So he would get there first, you know, unlock and lock up at the end of the day because he was there that long. But it was a belief that worked well for him. So we talk, you know, a lot about beliefs, and in psychology, they talk about it as a secondary gain. But basically, he didn't believe he was that good, which I found fascinating. But the fact he didn't believe he was that good, he thought he had to train harder than anybody in order to be up to the level. So he would work harder than anyone I've ever met in my life. And that, it worked out well for him though, didn't it, Lochie?
I learned a lot of him. I think he's the way he thought about things and went about things was, it was incredible, really, his actual beliefs. But he's definitely one of the hardest workers I've ever come across, but he worked hard in a different way. I'd like to think, you know, you worked hard and didn't work hard. I just thought it was natural for him at the time. That's another thing that was scary, how natural his ability was. Yeah. You know, he could just not warm up and come out and just be the business, I felt. Yeah. He was. I found Joe Hart was like that as well when we was with the 21s. I felt, say if the game was on a Saturday, on the Monday, kind of every day he'd slowly progress. And then when it came to Thursday, Friday, Saturday, he was, you know, like a different animal altogether. Yeah. It was like he could switch himself on towards the game, and they were interesting things to pick up on as well.
Well, do you know, to finish the podcast, we always ask the same question to the goalkeepers. So given that you are, in fact, you haven't mentioned this, but you are a regular listener, aren't you, Scott?
Yeah.
So you'll know exactly what I'm about to ask you. But, you know, you've been involved in goalkeeping for a long time. Hopefully, touch wood, you're going to be involved for a lot longer. But up to this point, what has goalkeeping given you?
Probably this crazy tag that everyone thinks I'm a bit weird. But it's given me so many things. You know, I love it. I really love the position. I'm fanatical about goalkeeping, and just give me a lot of enjoyment, really, because I think we can be different and get away with it, and I think that's what I enjoy about it.
Scott Loach, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Cheers. Thank you.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stephen Hunt's corner kick comes in. Back across the face of goal, off the crossbar. Still the danger not over the ball. Ping-pongs around the penalty area. What's the referee given here? And Scott Loach, who's only been on the field for a few minutes. It's been 10 minutes after replacing Mark Poo. Already called into action. But what's happening here? The players are surrounding the referee and his assistant. I think a goal's been given by Stuart Atwell. Unbelievably, Reading have taken the lead. I think he thought it had crossed the line when it deflected off John Eustace, and a goal has been given to Reading, and clearly it didn't cross the goal line. An own goal in the 13th minute. Unlucky, you may say, and how unlucky that 13th minute was.
Well, every guest that I know has worked with you, I'm trying to get to dish some dirt, and no one's doing it yet. Why is this?
The Model Pro, Matthew. The Model Pro.
There's got to be something out there.
Well, if you have something out there, let us know. How can they get in touch, Matthew?
Oh, nice, Richard. There we go. At GK Union on Twitter. Or drop us an email. hello@goalkeepersunion.net. One of these days you're going to do this.
Do you think?
It's going to come naturally to you. I'm standing by it. Great chat with Scott Loach there. Really, really good chat.
Yeah, it was. I got so much love for Loachy. And I saw a lot of his career, obviously the early days, the rise that he had. And it's a really interesting career. And the bit that I suppose I can't help but feel is the whole sliding doors scenario, where you think of how things might have been a little bit different. Now, that's not to take anything away from Loachy, because he's had an excellent career. Like I say, he played a lot more games at Watford than I did, a lot more games at Championship level than I did. And he's had a brilliant career. But there were key moments, and you look back and he's so honest. I love how honest he is in his appraisal of his career and his development. And the thing that really comes out to me is where he is now as a person, as a human being, with all the lessons that he has learned. And he is very much on his way back up now. Certainly anyone that's seen him over the last couple of years, he's playing the best football that he's ever played. But he had a bit of a tough time in between. Certain managers that he didn't click with, he's obviously had many highs and several lows too. But it's good to hear that he's in such a good place. And I'm confident that he'll climb the leagues again. Like, he could have been playing League Two now. Obviously, for family reasons, decided to stay in the National League. I'm sure it won't be long before he's League Two, League One, and as he says, maybe even Championship in time.
That move to Spurs, or non-move in the end, is really interesting, isn't it? Because I did mention Andrew Lonergan and the fact that he was potentially touted around Arsenal at around a similar time in his career.
Yeah, well, you're right. And this is it, where I think that, everyone looks back on their career and you look at certain moments that have gone your way, gone against you. Now, for those who listen to the podcast, I'm sure I've told this story 100 times, but I'll tell it again. A good one for myself was my debut, and I always remember, shot from the edge of the box, gone through my hands, and it grazed the bar and went over the bar. Now, you look back, there was another lad that made his debut on the same day as me, never played for the club again, and obviously I went on to have a career. So you look at things that go for you. Similarly, things that went against me at times, when there were times when maybe I was due to kick on and I didn't, or was due to get a move and it didn't happen. And so you can always look at the good things, the bad things, and you like to think that over time it evens itself out. And that's a good example, though, where what might have happened had he gone to Spurs. Now, it might be that he'd have had a very similar career path, or maybe not. You know, what would have happened had he chose a different club than Ipswich? What would have happened had he have got certain advice at a certain age? This is the kind of stuff that you never know. It's part of the beauty of being a goalkeeper as well, is that, and I'll touch on this a lot, and again, for all the younger goalkeepers listening, there's so many lessons you'll learn being a goalkeeper that will help you in other aspects of your life. You know, I certainly think from a personal point of view, I know that goalkeeping led me down the route of psychology. Psychology led me down the route of business and learned how to deal with people, and having built some of the things that I've done now and continue to learn, continue to build, as random as it sounds, come from being a goalkeeper, going through some of the pressures, some of the good times, the bad times. The amount you learn about yourself as a human being, I think, is huge. And that is the biggest thing that stuck out to me there speaking to Loachy. He sounds so much more settled now. He's learnt so much. He's loving his game again. He's got motivation for his game. And that wasn't always the case.
I liked what he said about personality as well. We mentioned Ricardo Muniz, the Notts County manager, who said that it was too soft. And he was kind of laughing about that, Loachy. And it was really interesting to hear what various managers were saying with regards to his personality and wanting him to change a little bit. And he quite honestly there said, well, my personality is my personality. Can you really change that?
This is why I asked him about playing the game. And that was the reason behind it, is I don't necessarily agree with playing the game, by the way. I love the idea that you are who you are, because The problem is that it's not always necessarily about you. You have to put yourself in the shoes of a manager. Now, here's a good example. Let's say that a manager has grown up seeing Peter Schmeichel as the best goalkeeper in the world. They're going to model their idea of a goalkeeper on Peter Schmeichel. Now, what happens if you're not Peter Schmeichel? You're not going to fit their model of what they see a goalkeeper to be. Now, the problem is, not everybody is a Peter Schmeichel. In fact, nobody is. Nobody's that height, that agility, that speed, power, and of course, the vocal aspect. He used to scream and shout at all of his players. So if you're not him, then of course, you're never going to quite fit the model that the manager wants. So I go back to playing the game. It's right, what is the manager looking for? If they want someone that's really vocal, can you be that little bit more vocal? Because then you're going to fit in with what they want. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So like this was a big thing. I knew an obvious one for myself was I couldn't fit into most models because I'm 5'11", 6 foot on a good day.
Where have we heard that before?
No, but I am, right. So with that being the point, of course, I'm not going to fit the model of a manager who wants a 6'4" goalkeeper. And I had to accept that. Now that limits my options. For a start, but then those I do still have options, but still those that then see the goalkeeper, how do you want your goalkeeper to play? And I actually asked this question all the managers I've worked for, what do you expect of me? Do you want me to play out? Do you want me to be hitting it into certain areas? Do you want me to be quite vocal? Do you want me to play high, etc., etc.? How, in terms of training, this is how I'd ordinarily train in a week. Monday, Tuesday I do this, Thursday, Friday I do this. Does that fit with you? Is that okay? And if it is, then at least I know the script as to how I can please my boss. It's the same in any work of life, by the way, any walk of life, sorry, is that you need to know what the boss wants in order to fit in and be able to succeed in what you do. So going back to that point, if he's being described as soft, because he's not soft, by the way, like soft is such a general term. Scott Loach is not soft. In fact, you know, seeing him do what he's done at Watford in the early days, I'd argue he's the complete opposite. In terms of a character, he's quite softly spoken. He's very calm in his ways, which I would see as a huge positive in a goalkeeper. But again, that's because my model of a goalkeeper isn't set in stone. Mine is quite flexible. Mine is about who is the most effective goalkeeper. I'm not necessarily going to look at the great save. I'm not necessarily going to look at the incredible side volley. I'm going to look at a general game and what they bring to the team. However, I'm not most managers. Most managers will have a set in stone idea as to what they believe a goalkeeper should be.
Okay, lastly, that ghost goal. Now, yeah. For me, this is a classic example again, and I've really experienced this since being in the media and working with footballers, and you put something from their career to them. Now, as a fan and a journalist, you're very excited about said moment. In this instance, a ghost goal on there. By the way, his debut as well. We didn't mention this in the podcast, but he made his he played in the Carling Cup for Watford, but he made his league debut by coming off the bench 4 minutes in. Yeah. So we've had this before with Andy Marshall at Norwich, Stephen Bywater at West Ham, and Kevin Pilkington at Manchester United, all of whom made their league debuts coming off the bench. So there's a bit of added pressure in that. Just a few moments later, this ghost goal happens. But it was quite interesting because I could tell that I was there going, right, Scott, it's the first ever on the Goalkeepers Union podcast, a ghost goal. Mm. Yeah, it was all right. Yeah, I don't remember it. And it's so funny because as a fan and a journalist, you go to it and you think that this is such a big moment for a goalkeeper when really he was a bit like, yeah, it happened, but was what it was.
Well, if anything, it's frustrating because you want your debut to be remembered for being your debut, really. And it's the fact is there was nothing. Also, I think part of it is there's nothing you can do. It's not like it was an error. Certainly, Loach did nothing wrong. As you mentioned, if I remember rightly, I think he got fingertips and it hit the bar on the and then it obviously came out. So it's one that gets talked about a lot because it's such a bizarre situation and frustrating from a goalkeeper's point of view that you've got a one next to your name. You've conceded a goal that was never a goal and you'll look at your records in years to come and think, well, that should be one less. You know, that's frustrating. But I kind of get why it's not such a big thing. There were certain things that happened in games that I played that people mentioned. You'd be like, oh, yeah, I kind of forgot that happened. Like, I wasn't necessarily that involved. It was a crazy thing that happened in the game, but it didn't happen to me personally.
Do you have that then? If I was to say to you, well, when you remember when you played at the Etihad, when you played at Old Trafford?
Yeah, I mean, there'd be games, the bigger games that I played, and certain things happened in those games that are quite memorable. But I guess if it's not happening to you personally, and it's not that much of, or doesn't have that much of an emotional impact. That's part of it, by the way, is you think of memories. Here's a general one for you. You think of memories that are strong for you in your past. The reason they're strong is that there would have been an emotional impact at the time. So I can remember some of my great saves. I can remember some of my big mistakes because I remember at that time, a good example, Patrick Berger, top corner, fingertip over the bar. We beat think it was Portsmouth 3-0 on the night, make the semi-final of the League Cup when I'm a 21-year-old, I can still picture that exact moment when he hit it, the way in which I moved, my dive, the feeling of my shoulder nearly popping out when I saved it from Patrick. I can remember it because emotionally, I was in that moment. Similarly, I can remember me making the hugest mistake of my life against Hull because emotionally, I was in that moment. A ghost goal happens. Do you know what? The emotions at the time will be a bit like, okay, that's annoying. Let's carry on. Let's see if we can win this game. But unless it is you personally, I don't know. I get where he's coming from. It wouldn't be as big a thing to me because it wasn't necessarily an error from him. It wasn't a great save from him. He wasn't actually involved. It was just a case of the referee making a horrendous decision.
Indeed. Well, that's it for another Goalkeepers Union podcast. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
We are the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon, Goalkeepers 365 and Love Sport Radio. We'll see you next time.